to the canyon wall below a panel of Anasazi pictographs, and he did so again in the doorway of a small masonry structure built by the Anasazi for storing grain. Nemo 1934, he scrawled, no doubt moved by the same impulse that compelled Chris McCandless to inscribe Alexander Supertramp, May 1992, on the wall of the Shoshana bus. An impulse not so different, perhaps, from that which inspired the Anasazi to embellish the rock with their own now indecipherable symbols. In any case, shortly after Royce carved his mark into the sandstone, he departed Davis Gulch and mysteriously disappeared, apparently by design. An extensive search shed no light on his whereabouts. He was simply gone, swallowed whole by the desert. 60 years later, we still know next to nothing about what became of him. Everett was born in Oakland, California in 1914, the younger of two sons raised by Christopher and Stella Royce. Christopher, a graduate of Harvard Divinity School, was a poet, a philosopher, and a Unitarian minister, although he earned his keep as a bureaucrat in the California penal system. Stella was a headstrong woman with bohemian tastes and driving artistic ambitions for both herself and her kin. She self-published a literary journal, the Royce Quartet, the cover of which was emblazoned with the family maxim, "Glorify the hour." A tight-knit bunch, the Royces were also a nomadic family, moving from Oakland to Fresno, to Los Angeles, to Boston, to Brooklyn, to New Jersey, to Indiana, before finally settling in Southern California, when Everett was 14. In Los Angeles, Everett attended the Otis Art School and Hollywood High. As a 16-year-old, he embarked on his first long solo trip, spending the summer of 1930 hitchhiking and trekking through Yosemite and Big Sur, ultimately winding up in Carmel. 2 days after arriving in the latter community, he brazenly knocked on the door of Edward Weston, who was sufficiently charmed by the overwrought young man to humor him. Over the next 2 months, the eminent photographer encouraged the boy's uneven but promising efforts at painting and block printing, and permitted Royce to hang around his studio with his own sons, Neil and Cole. At the end of the summer, Everett returned home, only long enough to earn a high school diploma, which he received in January 1931. Less than a month later, he was on the road again, tramping alone through the canyon lands of Utah, Arizona, and New Mexico, then a region nearly as sparsely populated and wrapped in mystique as Alaska is today. Except for a short, unhappy stint at UCLA, he dropped out after a single semester to his father's lasting dismay, two extended visits with his parents, and a winter in San Francisco, where he insinuated himself into the company of Dorothea Lange, Ansel Adams, and the painter Maynard Dixon, Royce would spend the remainder of his meteoric life on the move, living out of a backpack on very little money, sleeping in the dirt, cheerfully going hungry for days at a time. Royce was, in the words of Wallace Stegner, a callow romantic, an adolescent aesthete, an atavistic wanderer of the wastelands. At 18, in a dream, he saw himself plodding through jungles, chinning up the ledges of cliffs, wandering through the romantic waste places of the world. No man with any of the juices of boyhood in him has forgotten those dreams. The peculiar thing about Everett Royce was that he went out and did the things he dreamed about. Not simply for a 2 weeks' vacation in the civilized and trimmed wonderlands, but for months and years in the very midst of wonder. Deliberately he punished his body, strained his endurance, tested his capacity for strenuousness. He took out deliberately over trails that Indians and old-timers warned him against. He tackled cliffs that more than once left him dangling halfway between talus and rim. From his camps by the water pockets or the canyons or high on the timbered ridges of Navajo Mountain, he wrote long, lush, enthusiastic letters to his family and friends, damning the stereotypes of civilization, chanting his barbaric adolescent yawp into the teeth of the world. Royce turned out many such letters, which bore the postmarks of the remote settlements through which he passed. Kayenta, Chinle, Lukachake, Zion Canyon, Grand Canyon, Mesa Verde, Escalante, Rainbow Bridge, Canyon de Chelly. Reading this correspondence, collected in W.L. Russo's meticulously researched biography, Everett Royce, A Vagabond for Beauty, one is struck by Royce's craving for connection with the natural world and by his almost incendiary passion for the country through which he walked. I had some terrific experiences in the wilderness since I wrote you last. Overpowering, overwhelming, he gushed to his friend Cornell Tengle. But then I am always being overwhelmed. I require it to sustain life. Everett Royce's correspondence reveals uncanny parallels between Royce and Chris McCandless. Here are excerpts from three of Royce's letters. I have been thinking more and more that I shall always be a lone wanderer of the wilderness. God, how the trail lures me. You cannot comprehend its resistless fascination for me. After all, the lone trail is the best. I'll never stop wandering. And when the time comes to die, I'll find the wildest, loneliest, most desolate spot there is. The beauty of this country is becoming part of me. I feel more detached from life and somehow gentler. I have some good friends here, but no one who really understands why I am here or what I do. I don't know of anyone, though, who would have more than a partial understanding. I have gone too far alone. I have always been unsatisfied with life as most people live it. Always I want to live more intensely and richly. In my wanderings this year, I have taken more chances and had more wild adventures than ever before. And what magnificent country I have seen! Wild, tremendous wasteland stretches, lost mesas, blue mountains rearing up from the vermilion sands of the desert, canyons 5 feet wide at the bottom and hundreds of feet deep, cloudbursts roaring down unnamed canyons, and hundreds of houses of the cliff dwellers, abandoned 1,000 years ago. A half century later, McCandless sounds eerily like Royce when he declares in a postcard to Wayne Westerberg that, I've decided that I'm going to live this life for some time to come. The freedom and simple beauty of it is just too good to pass up. And echoes of Royce can be heard as well in McCandless's last letter to Ronald Franz. Royce was just as romantic as McCandless, if not more so, and equally heedless of personal safety. Claiborne Lockett, an archaeologist who briefly employed Royce as a cook while excavating an Anasazi cliff dwelling in 1934, told Ruscio that he was appalled by the seemingly reckless manner in which Everett moved around dangerous cliffs. Indeed, Royce himself boasts in one of his letters, "Hundreds of times I have trusted my life to crumbling sandstone and nearly vertical edges in the search for water or cliff dwellings. Twice I was nearly gored to death by a wild bull. But always, so far, I've escaped unscathed and gone forth to other adventures." And in his final letter, Royce nonchalantly confesses to his brother, "I have had a few narrow escapes from rattlers and crumbling cliffs. The last misadventure occurred when Chocolatero, his burrow, stirred up some wild bees. A few more stings might have been too much for me. I was 3 or 4 days getting my eyes open and recovering the use of my hands." Also like McCandless, Royce was undeterred by physical discomfort. At times he seemed to welcome it. "For 6 days I've been suffering from the semi-annual poison ivy case. My sufferings are far from over," he tells his friend Bill Jacobs. He goes on, "For 2 days I couldn't tell whether I was dead or alive. I writhed and twisted in the heat, with swarms of ants and flies crawling over me, while the poison oozed and crusted on my face and arms and back. I ate nothing. There was nothing to do but suffer philosophically. I get it every time, but I refuse to be driven out of the woods." And like McCandless, upon embarking on his terminal odyssey, Royce adopted a new name, or rather a series of new names. In a letter dated March 1, 1931, he informs his family that he has taken to calling himself Lan Rameau and requests that they please respect my brush name. How do you say it in French? Nom de bruche, or what? 2 months later, however, another letter explains that, "I have changed my name again, to Everett Roulin. Those who knew me formerly thought my name was freakish and an affectation of Frenchiness." And then in August of that same year, with no explanation, he goes back to calling himself Everett Royce and continues to do so for the next 3 years, until wandering into Davis Gulch. There, for some unknowable reason, Everett twice etched the name Nemo, Latin for nobody, into the soft Navajo sandstone, and then vanished. He was 20 years old. The last letters anyone received from Royce were posted from the Mormon settlement of Escalante, 57 miles north of Davis Gulch, on November 11, 1934. Addressed to his parents and his brother, they indicate that he would be incommunicado for a month or two. 8 days after mailing them, Royce encountered two sheepherders about a mile from the gulch and spent 2 nights at their camp. These men were the last people known to have seen the youth alive. Some 3 months after Royce departed Escalante, his parents received a bundle of unopened mail forwarded from the postmaster at Marble Canyon, Arizona, where Everett was long overdue. Worried, Christopher and Stella Royce contacted the authorities in Escalante, who organized a search party in early March 1935. Starting from the sheep camp where Royce was last seen, they began combing the surrounding country and very quickly found Everett's two burros at the bottom of Davis Gulch, grazing contentedly behind a makeshift corral fashioned from brush and tree limbs. The burros were confined in the upper canyon, just upstream from where the Mormon steps intersect the floor of the gulch. A short distance downstream, the searchers found unmistakable evidence of Royce's camp, and then, in the doorway of an Anasazi granary, below a magnificent natural arch, they came across Nemo 1934, carved into a stone slab. 4 Anasazi pots were carefully arranged on a rock nearby. 3 months later, searchers came across another Nemo graffito, a little farther down the gulch. The rising waters of Lake Powell, which began to fill upon the completion of Glen Canyon Dam in 1963, have long since erased both inscriptions. But except for the burros and their tack, none of Royce's possessions, his camping paraphernalia, journals, and paintings, was ever found. It is widely believed that Royce fell to his death while scrambling on one or another canyon wall. Given the treacherous nature of the local topography, most of the cliffs that riddle the region are composed of Navajo sandstone, a crumbly stratum that erodes into smooth, bulging precipices, and Royce's penchant for dangerous climbing, this is a credible scenario. Careful searches of cliffs near and far, however, have failed to unearth any human remains. And how to account for the fact that Royce apparently left the gulch with a heavy load of gear, but without his pack animals? These bewildering circumstances have led some investigators to conclude that Royce was murdered by a team of cattle rustlers, known to have been in the area, who then stole his belongings and buried his remains, or threw them into the Colorado River. This theory, too, is plausible, but no concrete evidence exists to prove it. Shortly after Everett's disappearance, his father suggested that the boy had probably been inspired to call himself Nemo by Jules Verne's 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, a book Everett read many times, in which the pure-hearted protagonist, Captain Nemo, flees civilization and severs his every tie upon the earth. Everett's biographer, W.L. Russo, agrees with Christopher Royce's assessment, arguing that Everett's withdrawal from organized society, his disdain for worldly pleasures, and his signatures as Nemo in Davis Gulch all strongly suggest that he closely identified with the Jules Verne character. Royce's apparent fascination with Captain Nemo has fed speculation among more than a few Royce mythographers that Everett pulled a fast one on the world after leaving Davis Gulch and is, or was, very much alive, quietly residing somewhere under an assumed identity. A year ago, while filling my truck with gas in Kingman, Arizona, I happened to strike up a conversation about Royce with the middle-aged pump attendant, a small, twitchy man with flecks of skull staining the corners of his mouth. Speaking with persuasive conviction, he swore that he knew a fella who definitely bumped into Royce in the late 1960s at a remote hogan on the Navajo Indian Reservation. According to the attendant's friend, Royce was married to a Navajo woman with whom he'd raised at least one child. The veracity of this and other reports of relatively recent Royce sightings, needless to say, is extremely suspect. Ken Slate, who has spent as much time investigating the riddle of Everett Royce as any other person, is convinced that the boy died in 1934 or early 1935 and believes he knows how Royce met his end. Slate, 65 years old, is a professional river guide and desert rat with a Mormon upbringing and a reputation for insolence. When Edward Abbey was writing The Monkey Wrench Gang, his picaresque novel about eco-terrorism in the canyon country, His pal Ken Slate was said to have inspired the character seldom-seen Smith. Slate has lived in the region for 40 years, visited virtually all the places Royce visited, talked to many people who crossed paths with Royce, taken Royce's older brother Waldo into Davis Gulch to visit the site of Everett's disappearance. "Waldo thinks Everett was murdered," Slate says, "but I don't think so. I lived in Escalante for 2 years. I've talked with the folks who were accused of killing him, and I just don't think they did it. But who knows? You can't never really tell what a person does in secret. Other folks believe Everett fell off a cliff. Well, yeah, he could have done that. It'd be an easy thing to do in that country. But I don't think that's what happened. I'll tell you what I think. I think he drowned." Years ago, while hiking down Grand Gulch, a tributary of the San Juan River some 45 miles due east of Davis Gulch, Slate discovered the name Nemo carved into the soft mud mortar of an Anasazi granary. Slate speculates that Royce inscribed this Nemo not long after departing Davis Gulch. "After corralling his burros in Davis," says Slate, "Royce hid all his stuff in a cave somewhere and took off, playing Captain Nemo. He had Indian friends down on the Navajo reservation, and that's where I think he was heading. A logical route to Navajo country would have taken Royce across the Colorado River at Hole in the Rock, then along a rugged trail pioneered in 1880 by Mormon settlers across Wilson Mesa and the Clay Hills, and finally down Grand Gulch to the San Juan River, across which lay the reservation. Everett carved his Nemo on the ruin in Grand Gulch about a mile below where Collins Creek comes in, then continued on down to the San Juan. And when he tried to swim across the river, he drowned. That's what I think." Slate believes that if Royce had made it across the river alive and reached the reservation, it would have been impossible for him to conceal his presence, even if he was still playing his Nemo game. Everett was a loner, but he liked people too damn much to stay down there and live in secret the rest of his life. A lot of us are like that. I'm like that. Ed Abbey was like that. And it sounds like this McCandless kid was like that. We like companionship, see, but we can't stand to be around people for very long. So we go get ourselves lost, come back for a while, then get the hell out again. And that's what Everett was doing. Everett was strange, Slate concedes. Kind of different, but him and McCandless, at least they tried to follow their dream. That's what was great about them. They tried. Not many do. In attempting to understand Everett Royce and Chris McCandless, it can be illuminating to consider their deeds in a larger context. It is helpful to look at counterparts from a distant place and a century far removed. Off the southeastern coast of Iceland sits a low barrier island called Papos. Treeless and rocky, perpetually clobbered by gales howling off the North Atlantic, it takes its name from its first settlers, now long gone, the Irish monks known as Papar. Walking this gnarled shore one summer afternoon, I blundered upon a matrix of faint stone rectangles embedded in the tundra, vestiges of the monks' ancient dwellings, hundreds of years older even than the Anasazi ruins in Davis Gulch. The monks arrived as early as the 5th and 6th centuries A.D., having sailed and rowed from the west coast of Ireland, setting out in small open boats called curraghs. Built from cowhide stretched over light wicker frames, they crossed one of the most treacherous stretches of ocean in the world without knowing what, if anything, they'd find on the other side. The Papar risked their lives and lost them in untold droves, not in the pursuit of wealth or personal glory or to claim new lands in the name of any despot. As the great Arctic explorer and Nobel laureate Fridtjof Nansen points out, these remarkable voyages were undertaken chiefly from the wish to find lonely places, where these anchorites might dwell in peace, undisturbed by the turmoil and temptations of the world. When the first handful of Norwegians showed up on the shores of Iceland in the 9th century, the Papar decided the country had become too crowded, even though it was still all but uninhabited. The monks' response was to climb into their curraghs and row off toward Greenland. They were drawn across the storm-racked ocean, drawn west past the edge of the known world, by nothing more than a hunger of the spirit, a yearning of such queer intensity that it beggars the modern imagination. Reading of these monks, one is moved by their courage, their reckless innocence, and the urgency of their desire. Reading of these monks, one can't help thinking of Everett Royce and Chris McCandless. Chapter 10. Fairbanks. Dying in the Wild, a Hiker Recorded the Terror. Anchorage, September 12th, AP. Last Sunday, a young hiker, stranded by an injury, was found dead at a remote camp in the Alaskan interior. No one is yet certain who he was, but his diary and two notes found at the camp tell a wrenching story of his desperate and progressively futile efforts to survive. The diary indicates that the man, believed to be an American in his late 20s or early 30s, might have been injured in a fall, and that he was then stranded at the camp for more than 3 months. It tells how he tried to save himself by hunting game and eating wild plants, while nonetheless getting weaker. One of his two notes is a plea for help, addressed to anyone who might come upon the camp while the hiker searched the surrounding area for food. The second note bids the world goodbye. An autopsy at the state coroner's office in Fairbanks this week found that the man had died of starvation, probably in late July. The authorities discovered among the man's possessions a name that they believe is his, but they have so far been unable to confirm his identity and, until they do, have declined to disclose the name. The New York Times, September 13th, 1992. By the time the New York Times picked up the story about the hiker, the Alaska State Troopers had been trying for a week to figure out who he was. When he died, McCandless was wearing a blue sweatshirt printed with the logo of a Santa Barbara towing company. When contacted, the wrecking outfit professed to know nothing about him or how he'd acquired the shirt. Many of the entries in the brief, perplexing diary recovered with the body were terse observations of flora and fauna, which fueled speculation that McCandless was a field biologist. But that ultimately led nowhere, too. On September 10th, 3 days before the news of the dead hiker appeared in the Times, the story was published on the front page of the Anchorage Daily News. When Jim Gallion saw the headline and the accompanying map indicating that the body had been found 25 miles west of Healy on the Stampede Trail, he felt the hairs bristle across the base of his scalp. Alex. Gallion still held a picture in his mind of the odd, congenial youth striding down the trail in boots two sizes too big for him, Gallion's own boots, the old brown extra tufts he'd persuaded the kid to take. From the newspaper article, what little information there was, it sounded like the same person, says Gallion. So I called the state troopers and said, "Hey, I think I gave that guy a ride." "Okay, sure," replied Trooper Roger Ellis, the cop on the other end of the line. "What makes you think so? You're the sixth person in the last hour who's called to say they know the hiker's identity." But Gallion persisted, and the more he talked, the more Ellis's skepticism receded. Gallion described several pieces of equipment not mentioned in the newspaper account that matched gear found with the body, and then Ellis noticed that the first cryptic entry in the hiker's journal read, "Exit Fairbanks. Sitting Gallion. Rabbit Day." The troopers had by this time developed the role of film in the hiker's Minolta, which included several apparent self-portraits. "When they brought the pictures out to the job site where I was working," says Gallion, "there was no two ways about it. The guy in the pictures was Alex." Because McCandless had told Gallion he was from South Dakota, the troopers immediately shifted their search there for the hiker's next of kin. An all-points bulletin turned up a missing person named McCandless from eastern South Dakota, coincidentally from a small town only 20 miles from Wayne Westerberg's home in Carthage, and for a while the troopers thought they'd found their man. But this, too, turned out to be a false lead. Westerberg had heard nothing from the friend he knew as Alex McCandless since receiving the postcard from Fairbanks the previous spring. On September 13th, he was rolling down an empty ribbon of blacktop outside Jamestown, North Dakota, leading his harvest crew home to Carthage after wrapping up the four-month cutting season in Montana, when the VHF barked to life. "Wayne," an anxious voice crackled over the radio from one of the crew's other trucks. "This is Bob. You got your radio on?" "Yeah, Bobby. Wayne here. What's up?" "Quick, turn on your AM and listen to Paul Harvey. He's talking about some kid who starved to death up in Alaska. The police don't know who he is. Sounds a whole lot like Alex." Westerberg found the station in time to catch the tail end of the Paul Harvey broadcast, and he was forced to agree. The few sketchy details made the anonymous hiker sound distressingly like his friend. As soon as he got to Carthage, a dispirited Westerberg phoned the Alaska State Troopers to volunteer what he knew about McCandless. By that time, however, stories about the dead hiker, including excerpts from his diary, had been given prominent play in newspapers across the country. As a consequence, the troopers were swamped with calls from people claiming to know the hiker's identity, so they were even less receptive to Westerberg than they had been to Galleon. The cop told me they'd had more than 150 calls from folks who thought Alex was their kid, their friend, their brother, says Westerberg. Well, by then, I was kind of pissed at getting the runaround, so I told him, "Look, I'm not just another crank caller. I know who he is. He worked for me. I think I've even got his social security number around here somewhere." Westerberg pawed through the files at the grain elevator until he found two W-4 forms McCandless had filled out. Across the top of the first one, dating from McCandless's initial visit to Carthage in 1990, he had scrawled, "Exempt, exempt, exempt, exempt," and given his name as Iris Fuck You. Address, none of your damn business. Social security number, I forget. But on the second form, dated March 30th, 1992, 2 weeks before he left for Alaska, he'd signed his given name, Chris J. McCandless, and in the blank for social security number, he'd put down 228-31-6704. Westerberg phoned Alaska again. This time, the troopers took him seriously. The social security number turned out to be genuine and placed McCandless's permanent residence in northern Virginia. Authorities in Alaska contacted law enforcement agencies in that state, who in turn started combing phone directories for McCandlesses. Walt and Billy McCandless had by then moved to the Maryland shore and no longer had a Virginia phone number. But Walt's eldest child from his first marriage lived in Annandale and was in the book. Late on the afternoon of September 17th, Sam McCandless received a call from a Fairfax County homicide detective. Sam, 9 years older than Chris, had seen a short article about the hiker in the Washington Post a few days earlier. But he allows, "It didn't occur to me that the hiker might be Chris. Never even crossed my mind. It's ironic because when I read the article, I thought, oh my God, what a terrible tragedy. I really feel sorry for the family of this guy, whoever they are. What a sad story." Sam had been raised in California and Colorado, in his mother's household, and hadn't moved to Virginia until 1987, after Chris had left the state to attend college in Atlanta, so Sam didn't know his half-brother well. But when the homicide detective started asking whether the hiker sounded like anyone he knew, Sam reports, "I was pretty sure it was Chris. The fact that he'd gone to Alaska, that he'd gone off by himself, it all added up." At the detective's request, Sam went to the Fairfax County Police Department, where an officer showed him a photograph of the hiker that had been faxed from Fairbanks. "It was an 8x10 enlargement," Sam recalls. "A headshot. His hair was long, and he had a beard. Chris almost always had short hair and was clean-shaven, and the face in the picture was extremely gaunt. But I knew right away. There was no doubt. It was Chris. I went home, picked up Michelle, my wife, and drove out to Maryland to tell Dad and Billy. I didn't know what I was going to say. How do you tell someone that their child is dead?" Chapter 11. Chesapeake Beach. Everything had changed suddenly. The tone, the moral climate. You didn't know what to think, whom to listen to, as if all your life you had been led by the hand like a small child, and suddenly you were on your own. You had to learn to walk by yourself. There was no one around, neither family nor people whose judgment you respected. At such a time, you felt the need of committing yourself to something absolute, life or truth or beauty, of being ruled by it in place of the man-made rules that had been discarded. You needed to surrender to some such ultimate purpose more fully, more unreservedly than you had ever done in the old familiar peaceful days, in the old life that was now abolished and gone for good. Boris Pasternak, Dr. Zhivago. Passage highlighted in one of the books found with Chris McCandless's remains. Need for a purpose had been written in McCandless's hand in the margin above the passage. Samuel Walter McCandless, Jr., 56 years old, is a bearded, taciturn man with longish salt-and-pepper hair combed straight back from a high forehead. Tall and solidly proportioned, he wears wire-rimmed glasses that give him a professorial demeanor. 7 weeks after the body of his son turned up in Alaska wrapped in a blue sleeping bag that Billy had sewn for Chris from a kit, Walt studies a sailboat scudding beneath the window of his waterfront townhouse. How is it, he wonders aloud as he gazes blankly across Chesapeake Bay, that a kid with so much compassion could cause his parents so much pain? The McCandless home in Chesapeake Beach, Maryland, is tastefully decorated, spotless, devoid of clutter. Floor-to-ceiling windows take in the hazy panorama of the bay. A big Chevy Suburban and a white Cadillac are parked out front. A painstakingly restored 69 Corvette sits in the garage. A 30-foot cruising catamaran is moored at the dock. 4 large squares of poster board, covered with scores of photos documenting the whole brief span of Chris's life, have occupied the dining room table for many days now. Moving deliberately around the display, Billy points out Chris as a toddler astride a hobby horse, Chris as a rapt 8-year-old in a yellow rain slicker on his first backpacking trip, Chris at his high school commencement. The hardest part, says Walt, pausing over a shot of his own son clowning around on a family vacation, his voice cracking almost imperceptibly, is simply not having him around anymore. I spent a lot of time with Chris, perhaps more than with any of my other kids. I really liked his company, even though he frustrated us so often. Walt is wearing gray sweatpants, racquetball shoes, and a satin baseball jacket embroidered with the logo of the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. Despite the casual attire, he projects an air of authority. Within the ranks of his arcane field, an advanced technology called Synthetic Aperture Radar, or SAR, he is an eminence. SAR has been a component of high-profile space missions since 1978, when the first SAR-equipped satellite, CSAT, was placed into orbit around the Earth. NASA's project manager for that pioneering CSAT launch was Walt McCandless. The first line of Walt's resume reads, "Clearance, current U.S. Department of Defense, top secret." A little farther down the page, an account of his professional experience begins, "I perform private consulting services aligned with remote sensor and satellite system design and associated signal processing, data reduction, and information extraction tasks." Colleagues refer to him as brilliant. Walt is accustomed to calling the shots. Taking control is something he does unconsciously, reflexively. Although he speaks softly in the unhurried cadence of the American West, his voice has an edge, and the set of his jaw betrays an undercurrent of nervous energy. Even from across the room, it is apparent that some very high voltage is crackling through his wires. There is no mistaking whence Chris's intensity came. When Walt talks, people listen. If something or someone displeases him, his eyes narrow and his speech becomes clipped. According to members of the extended family, his moods can be dark and mercurial, although they say his famous temper has lost much of its volatility in recent years. After Chris gave everybody the slip in 1990, something changed in Walt. His son's disappearance scared and chastened him. A softer, more tolerant side of his personality came to the fore. Walt grew up poor in Greeley, Colorado, an agricultural town on the high, windswept plains up near the Wyoming line. His family, he declares matter-of-factly, was from the wrong side of the tracks. A bright child and driven, he won an academic scholarship to Colorado State University in nearby Fort Collins.
This book is continued on Disc 4. Disc 4.
A bright child and driven, he won an academic scholarship to Colorado State University in nearby Fort Collins. To make ends meet, he held down an assortment of part-time jobs through college, including one in a mortuary, but his steadiest paycheck came from playing with Charlie Novak, the leader of a popular jazz quartet. Novak's band, with Walt sitting in on piano, worked the regional lounge circuit, covering dance numbers and old standards in smoky honky-tonks up and down the front range. An inspired musician with considerable natural talent, Walt still plays professionally from time to time. In 1957, the Soviets launched Sputnik 1, casting a shadow of fear across America. In the ensuing national hysteria, Congress funneled millions upon millions of dollars into the California-based aerospace industry, and the boom was on. For young Walt McCandless, just out of college, married, and with a baby on the way, Sputnik opened the door to opportunity. After receiving his undergraduate diploma, Walt took a job with Hughes Aircraft, which sent him to Tucson for 3 years, where he earned a master's degree in antenna theory from the University of Arizona. As soon as he completed his thesis, an analysis of conical helices, he transferred to Hughes's big California operation, where the real action was, eager to make his mark in the race for space. He bought a little bungalow in Torrance, worked hard, moved quickly up the ladder. Sam was born in 1959, and four other children, Stacy, Shauna, Shelley, and Shannon, followed in quick succession. Walt was appointed test director and section head for the Surveyor 1 mission, the first spacecraft to make a soft landing on the moon. His star was bright and rising. By 1965, however, his marriage was in trouble. He and his wife, Marcia, separated. Walt started dating a secretary at Hughes named Wilhelmina Johnson. Everyone called her Billy, who was 22 years old and had dark, striking eyes. They fell in love and moved in together. Billy got pregnant. Very petite to begin with, in 9 months she gained only 8 pounds and never even wore maternity clothes. On February 12, 1968, Billy gave birth to a son. He was underweight, but healthy and animated. Walt bought Billy a Giannini guitar, on which she strummed lullabies to soothe the fussy newborn. 22 years later, rangers from the National Park Service would find that same guitar on the back seat of a yellow Datsun abandoned near the shore of Lake Mead. It is impossible to know what murky convergence of chromosomal matter, parent-child dynamics, and alignment of the cosmos was responsible, but Christopher Johnson McCandless came into the world with unusual gifts and a will not easily deflected from its trajectory. At the age of 2, he got up in the middle of the night, found his way outside without waking his parents, and entered a house down the street to plunder a neighbor's candy drawer. In the 3rd grade, after receiving a high score on a standardized achievement test, Chris was placed in an accelerated program for gifted students. He wasn't happy about it, Billy remembers, because it meant he had to do extra schoolwork, so he spent a week trying to get himself out of the program. This little boy attempted to convince the teacher, the principal, anybody who would listen, that the test results were in error, that he really didn't belong there. We learned about it at the first PTA meeting. His teacher pulled us aside and told us that Chris marches to a different drummer. She just shook her head. Even when we were little, says Corrine, who was born 3 years after Chris, he was very to himself. He wasn't antisocial. He always had friends and everybody liked him. But he could go off and entertain himself for hours. He didn't seem to need toys or friends. He could be alone without being lonely. When Chris was 6, Walt was offered a position at NASA, prompting a move to the nation's capital. They bought a split-level house on Willett Drive in suburban Annandale. It had green shutters, a bay window, a nice yard. 4 years after arriving in Virginia, Walt quit working for NASA to start a consulting firm, User Systems Incorporated, which he and Billy ran out of their home. Money was tight. In addition to the financial strain of exchanging a steady paycheck for the vagaries of self-employment, Walt's separation from his first wife left him with 2 families to support. To make a go of it, says Corrine, Mom and Dad put in incredibly long hours. When Chris and I woke up in the morning to go to school, they'd be in the office working. When we came home in the afternoon, they'd be in the office working. When we went to bed at night, they'd be in the office working. They ran a real good business together and eventually started making bunches of money, but they worked all the time. It was a stressful existence. Both Walt and Billy are tightly wound, emotional, loath to give ground. Now and then, the tension erupted in verbal sparring. In moments of anger, one or the other often threatened divorce. The rancor was more smoke than fire, says Corrine, but I think it was one of the reasons Chris and I were so close. We learned to count on each other when Mom and Dad weren't getting along. But there were good times, too. On weekends and when school was out, the family took to the road. They drove to Virginia Beach and the Carolina Shore, to Colorado to visit Walt's kids from his first marriage, to the Great Lakes, to the Blue Ridge Mountains. We camped out of the back of the truck, the Chevy Suburban, Walt explains. Later, we bought an Airstream trailer and traveled with that. Chris loved those trips, the longer the better. There was always a little wanderlust in the family, and it was clear early on that Chris had inherited it. In the course of their travels, the family visited Iron Mountain, Michigan, a small mining town in the forests of the Upper Peninsula that was Billy's childhood home. She was one of six kids. Lauren Johnson, Billy's father, ostensibly worked as a truck driver, but he never held any job for long, she says. Billy's dad didn't quite fit into society, Walt explains. In many ways, he and Chris were a lot alike. Lauren Johnson was proud and stubborn and dreamy, a woodsman, a self-taught musician, a writer of poetry. Around Iron Mountain, his rapport with the creatures of the forest was legendary. He was always raising wildlife, says Billy. He'd find some animal in a trap, take it home, amputate the injured limb, heal it, and then let it go again. Once my dad hit a mother deer with his truck, making an orphan of its fawn. He was crushed. But he brought the baby deer home and raised it inside the house behind the wood stove, just like it was one of his kids. To support his family, Lauren tried a series of entrepreneurial ventures, none of them very successful. He raised chickens for a while, then mink and chinchillas. He opened a stable and sold horse rides to tourists. Much of the food he put on the table came from hunting, despite the fact that he was uncomfortable killing animals. My dad cried every time he shot a deer, Billy says, but we had to eat, so he did it. He also worked as a hunting guide, which pained him even more. Men from the city would drive up in their big Cadillacs, and my dad would take them out to his hunting camp for a week to get a trophy. He would guarantee them a buck before they left. But most of them were such lousy shots and drank so much that they couldn't hit anything, so he'd usually have to shoot the deer for them. God, he hated that. Lauren, not surprisingly, was charmed by Chris. And Chris adored his grandfather. The old man's backwoods savvy, his affinity for the wilderness, left a deep impression on the boy. When Chris was 8, Walt took him on his first overnight backpacking trip, a 3-day hike in the Shenandoah to climb Old Rag. They made the summit, and Chris carried his own pack the whole way. Hiking up the mountain became a father-son tradition. They climbed Old Rag almost every year thereafter. When Chris was a little older, Walt took Billy and his children from both marriages to climb Long's Peak in Colorado, at 14,256 feet, the highest summit in Rocky Mountain National Park. Walt, Chris, and Walt's youngest son from his first marriage reached the 13,000-foot elevation. There, at a prominent notch called the Keyhole, Walt decided to turn around. He was tired and feeling the altitude. The route above looked slabby, exposed, dangerous. "I'd had it, okay," Walt explains. But Chris wanted to keep going to the top. I told him no way. He was only 12 then, so all he could do was complain. If he'd been 14 or 15, he would have simply gone on without me. Walt grows quiet, staring absently into the distance. Chris was fearless, even when he was little, he says after a long pause. He didn't think the odds applied to him. We were always trying to pull him back from the edge. Chris was a high achiever in almost everything that caught his fancy. Academically, he brought home A's with little effort. Only once did he receive a grade lower than B, an F, in high school physics. When he saw the report card, Walt made an appointment with the physics teacher to see what the problem was. He was a retired Air Force colonel, Walt remembers, an old guy, traditional, pretty rigid. He'd explained at the beginning of the semester that because he had something like 200 students, lab reports had to be written in a particular format to make grading them a manageable proposition. Chris thought it was a stupid rule and decided to ignore it. He did his lab reports, but not in the correct format. So the teacher gave him an F. After talking with the guy, I came home and told Chris he got the grade he deserved. Both Chris and Corrine shared Walt's musical aptitude. Chris took up the guitar, piano, French horn. "It was strange to see in a kid his age," says Walt, "but he loved Tony Bennett. He'd sing numbers like Tender is the Night while I accompanied him on piano. He was good." Indeed, in a goofy video Chris made in college, he can be heard belting out Summers by the Sea, Sailboats in Capri, with impressive panache, crooning like a professional lounge singer. A gifted French horn player, as a teen he was a member of the American University Symphony, but quit, according to Walt, after objecting to rules imposed by a high school band leader. Corrine recalls that there was more to it than that. "He quit playing partly because he didn't like being told what to do, but also because of me. I wanted to be like Chris, so I started to play French horn too, and it turned out to be the one thing I was better at than he was. When I was a freshman and he was a senior, I made first chair in the senior band, and there was no way he was going to sit behind his damn sister." Their musical rivalry seems not to have damaged the relationship between Chris and Corrine, however. They'd been best friends from an early age, spending hours together building forts out of cushions and blankets in their Annandale living room. "He was always really nice to me," Corrine says, "and extremely protective. He'd hold my hand when we walked down the street. When he was in junior high and I was still in grade school, he got out earlier than me, but he'd hang out at his friend Brian Paskowitz's house so we could walk home together." Chris inherited Billy's angelic features, most notably her eyes, the black depths of which betrayed his every emotion. Although he was small, in school photographs he is always in the front row, the shortest kid in the class, Chris was strong for his size and well-coordinated. He tried his hand at many sports but had little patience for learning the finer points of any of them. When he went skiing during family vacations in Colorado, he seldom bothered to turn. He'd simply crouch in a gorilla tuck, feet spread wide for stability, and point the boards straight down the hill. Likewise, says Walt, "when I tried to teach him to play golf, he refused to accept that form is everything. Chris would take the biggest swing you ever saw, every time. Sometimes he'd hit the ball 300 yards, but more often he'd slice it into the next fairway." "Chris had so much natural talent," Walt continues, "but if you tried to coach him, to polish his skill, to bring out that final 10%, a wall went up. He resisted instruction of any kind. I'm a serious racquetball player, and I taught Chris to play when he was 11. By the time he was 15 or 16, he was beating me regularly. He was very, very quick and had a lot of power, but when I suggested he work on the gaps in his game, he refused to listen. Once, in a tournament, he came up against a 45-year-old man with a lot of experience. Chris won a bunch of points right out of the gate, but the guy was methodically testing him, probing for his weakness. As soon as he figured out which shot gave Chris the most trouble, that was the only shot Chris saw, and it was all over." Nuance, strategy, and anything beyond the rudimentaries of technique were wasted on Chris. The only way he cared to tackle a challenge was head-on, right now, applying the full brunt of his extraordinary energy. And he was often frustrated as a consequence. It wasn't until he took up running, an activity that rewards will and determination more than finesse or cunning, that he found his athletic calling. At the age of 10, he entered his first running competition, a 10-kilometer road race. He finished 69th, beating more than 1,000 adults, and was hooked. By the time he was in his teens, he was one of the top distance runners in the region. When Chris was 12, Walt and Billy bought Corrine a puppy, a Shetland sheepdog named Buckley, and Chris fell into the habit of taking the pet with him on his daily training runs. "Buckley was supposedly my dog," says Corrine, "but he and Chris became inseparable. Buck was fast, and he'd always beat Chris home when they went running. I remember Chris was so excited the first time he made it home before Buckley. He went tearing all over the house, yelling, 'I beat Buck! I beat Buck!'" At W.T. Woodson High School, a large public institution in Fairfax, Virginia, with a reputation for high academic standards and winning athletic teams, Chris was the captain of the cross-country squad. He relished the role and concocted novel, grueling training regimens that his teammates still remember well. "He was really into pushing himself," explains Gordy Kakulu, a younger member of the team. "Chris invented this workout he called Road Warriors. He would lead us on long killer runs through places like farmers' fields and construction sites, places we weren't supposed to be, and intentionally try to get us lost. We'd run as far and as fast as we could down strange roads, through the woods, whatever. The whole idea was to lose our bearings, push ourselves into unknown territory. Then we'd run at a slightly slower pace until we found a road we recognized and race home again at full speed. In a certain sense, that's how Chris lived his entire life. McCandless viewed running as an intensely spiritual exercise, verging on religion. Chris would use the spiritual aspect to try and motivate us, recalls Eric Hathaway, another friend on the team. He'd tell us to think about all the evil in the world, all the hatred, and imagine ourselves running against the forces of darkness, the evil wall that was trying to keep us from running our best. He believed doing well was all mental, a simple matter of harnessing whatever energy was available. As impressionable high school kids, we were blown away by that kind of talk. But running wasn't exclusively an affair of the spirit. It was a competitive undertaking as well. When McCandless ran, he ran to win. Chris was really serious about running, says Chris Maxey Gilmer, a female teammate who was perhaps McCandless's closest friend at Woodson. I can remember standing at the finish line, watching him run, knowing how badly he wanted to do well and how disappointed he'd be if he did worse than he expected. After a bad race or even a bad time trial during practice, he could be really hard on himself, and he wouldn't want to talk about it. If I tried to console him, he'd act annoyed and brush me off. He internalized the disappointment. He'd go off alone somewhere and beat himself up. It wasn't just running Chris took so seriously, Gilmer adds. He was like that about everything. You aren't supposed to think about heavy-duty stuff in high school, but I did, and he did too, which is why we hit it off. We'd hang out during snack break at his locker and talk about life, the state of the world, serious things. I'm black, and I could never figure out why everyone made such a big deal about race. Chris would talk to me about that kind of thing. He understood. He was always questioning stuff in the same way. I liked him a lot. He was a really good guy. McCandless took life's inequities to heart. During his senior year at Woodson, he became obsessed with racial oppression in South Africa. He spoke seriously to his friends about smuggling weapons into that country and joining the struggle to end apartheid. We'd get into arguments about it once in a while, recalls Hathaway. Chris didn't like going through channels, working within the system, waiting his turn. He'd say, "Come on, Eric, we can raise enough money to go to South Africa on our own, right now. It's just a matter of deciding to do it." I'd counter by saying we were only a couple of kids, that we couldn't possibly make a difference. But you couldn't argue with him. He'd come back with something like, "Oh, so I guess you just don't care about right and wrong." On weekends, when his high school pals were attending keggers and trying to sneak into Georgetown bars, McCandless would wander the seedier quarters of Washington, chatting with prostitutes and homeless people, buying them meals, earnestly suggesting ways they might improve their lives. Chris didn't understand how people could possibly be allowed to go hungry, especially in this country, says Billy. He would rave about that kind of thing for hours. On one occasion, Chris picked up a homeless man from the streets of D.C., brought him home to leafy, affluent Annandale, and secretly set the guy up in the Airstream trailer his parents parked beside the garage. Walt and Billy never knew they were hosting a vagrant. On another occasion, Chris drove over to Hathaway's house and announced they were going downtown. "Cool," Hathaway remembers thinking. "It was a Friday night, and I assumed we were headed to Georgetown to party." Instead, Chris parked down on 14th Street, which at the time was a real bad part of town. Then he said, "You know, Eric, you can read about this stuff, but you can't understand it until you live it. Tonight, that's what we're going to do." We spent the next few hours hanging out in creepy places, talking with pimps and hookers and lowlife. I was, like, scared. Toward the end of the evening, Chris asked me how much money I had. I said $5. He had 10. "Okay, you buy the gas," he told me. "I'm going to get some food." So he spent the $10 on a big bag of hamburgers, and we drove around handing them out to smelly guys sleeping on grates. It was the weirdest Friday night of my life. But Chris did that kind of thing a lot. Early in his senior year at Woodson, Chris informed his parents that he had no intention of going to college. When Walt and Billy suggested that he needed a college degree to attain a fulfilling career, Chris answered that careers were demeaning 20th century inventions, more of a liability than an asset, and that he would do fine without one, thank you. That put us into kind of a tizzy, Walt admits. Both Billy and I come from blue-collar families. A college degree is something we don't take lightly, okay? And we worked hard to be able to afford to send our kids to good schools. So Billy sat him down and said, Chris, if you really want to make a difference in the world, if you really want to help people who are less fortunate, get yourself some leverage first. Go to college, get a law degree, and then you'll be able to have a real impact. Chris brought home good grades, says Hathaway. He didn't get into trouble. He was a high achiever. He did what he was supposed to. His parents didn't really have grounds to complain, but they got on his case about going to college, and whatever they said to him, it must have worked, because he ended up going to Emory, even though he thought it was pointless, a waste of time and money. It was somewhat surprising that Chris ceded to pressure from Walt and Billy about attending college when he refused to listen to them about so many other things. But there was never a shortage of apparent contradictions in the relationship between Chris and his parents. When Chris visited with Chris Gilmer, he frequently railed against Walt and Billy, portraying them as unreasonable tyrants. Yet to his male buddies, Hathaway, Kukulu, and another track star, Andy Horowitz, he scarcely complained at all. My impression was that his parents were very nice people, says Hathaway. No different, really, than my parents or anyone's parents. Chris just didn't like being told what to do. I think he would have been unhappy with any parents. He had trouble with the whole idea of parents. McCandless's personality was puzzling in its complexity. He was intensely private, but could be convivial and gregarious in the extreme. And despite his overdeveloped social conscience, he was no tight-lipped, perpetually grim do-gooder who frowned on fun. To the contrary, he enjoyed tipping a glass now and then and was an incorrigible ham. Perhaps the greatest paradox concerned his feelings about money. Walt and Billy had both known poverty when they were young, and after struggling to rise above it, saw nothing wrong with enjoying the fruits of their labor. We worked very, very hard, Billy emphasizes. We did without when the kids were little, saved what we earned, and invested it for the future. When the future finally arrived, they didn't flaunt their modest wealth, but they bought nice clothes, some jewelry for Billy, a Cadillac. Eventually, they purchased the townhouse on the bay and the sailboat. They took the kids to Europe, skiing in Breckenridge, on a Caribbean cruise. And Chris, Billy acknowledges, was embarrassed by all that. Her son, the teenage Tolstoyan, believed that wealth was shameful, corrupting, inherently evil, which is ironic because Chris was a natural-born capitalist with an uncanny knack for making a buck. Chris was always an entrepreneur, Billy says with a laugh. Always. As an 8-year-old, he grew vegetables behind the house in Annandale and then sold them door-to-door around the neighborhood. Here was this cute little boy pulling a wagon full of fresh-grown beans and tomatoes and peppers, says Corrine. Who could resist? And Chris knew it. He'd have this look on his face like, I'm damn cute. Want to buy some beans? By the time he came home, the wagon would be empty, and he'd have a bunch of money in his hand. When Chris was 12, he printed up a stack of flyers and started a neighborhood copy business, Chris's Fast Copies, offering free pickup and delivery. Using the copier in Walt and Billy's office, he paid his parents a few cents a copy, charged customers 2 cents less than the corner store charged, and made a tidy profit. In 1985, following his junior year at Woodson, Chris was hired by a local building contractor to canvas neighborhoods for sales, drumming up siding jobs and kitchen remodelings. And he was astonishingly successful, a salesman without peer. In a matter of a few months, half a dozen other students were working under him, and he'd put $7,000 into his bank account. He used part of the money to buy the yellow Datsun, the second-hand B210. Chris had such an outstanding knack for selling that in the spring of 1986, as Chris's high school graduation approached, the owner of the construction company phoned Walt and offered to pay for Chris's college education if Walt would persuade his son to remain in Annandale and keep working while he went to school instead of quitting the job and going off to Emory. When I mentioned the offer to Chris, says Walt, he wouldn't even consider it. He told his boss that he had other plans. As soon as high school was over, Chris declared he was going to get behind the wheel of his new car and spend the summer driving across the country. Nobody anticipated that the journey would be the first in a series